This is David Lukens interviewing Jim Fitz about an experience in Colombia.
Hi. I was a volunteer in Colombia. This all happened in about 2002. I was a part of a team, Christian Peacemaker teams, that was accompanying 80 farm families who were threatened by guerrillas and paramilitaries in the Colombian Army. And we were accompanying them so they could stay on their farms. And the farmers told us if we weren't there, they would have had to, long before that, would have had to leave their farms. So they were very grateful that we were there.
What do you mean, accompany them? How did that work?
Well, we just went to visit them in their homes. This was in a rural area all along the Opon River. And so we would just be there. If the paramilitaries or the guerrillas came, we would go there. If we heard of they were over at Joe's house, say, we would go there. Sometimes we'd even stay overnight till they left. I better back up a little bit. Tell about the war.
Yeah. So essentially, did the paramilitary see you? Did they see that you were there with the farmers?
Well, sure. Yeah.
So they knew you. Okay. Tell about the war.
The war started about 50 years ago when about 10% of the population controlled about 90% of the tillable land in the country, and it got to the point where the farmers no longer had enough land to sustain their families. So they took up arms and formed the guerrilla group, the FARC, to take over some of those lands that they needed to sustain their families. And then when they did that, the wealthy people who owned the land hired mercenaries to protect their lands from these guerrilla groups, and they became known as the paramilitaries. So if the paramilitaries and the guerrillas are fighting each other, that's the way the war started. Today, today the war is much more over drugs, which everyone knows about, that comes from Colombia. And what else want to say about that?
Actually, this story occurred about 2002?
Yes.
So the war was hot at that time.
Oh, yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you talked about visiting a neighborhood and having a demonstration there.
Tell about
that demonstration.
One of the reasons we went to visit that neighborhood, we had heard that the paramilitaries were making people disappear in that neighborhood. And so we thought with our presence we could stop that. And so we took a tree there, planted it as a way of saying, we want life in this neighborhood instead of death and kidnappings. So we did the demonstration, and afterwards, we were just standing around and saw over on a table, there were a number of guys standing around sitting, and some of them sitting, and we went over to visit them. Well, it's one of the things we do is, even our opponents, we want to be friends with them. And so we went over, and we suspected they were paramilitaries. And did I tell you about the pita bite yet?
No, you haven't told why you needed a healer.
Oh, right. Anyway, probably several weeks before this, I had gotten bitten by a pita, which is I've never seen one, but like a giant mosquito. maybe an inch high or so. And I'd gone to the hospital and gotten antibiotic shots to try and thought maybe that would help deal with it. But the in the hospital, the doctor said, well, you want to keep this out in the air. So I was wearing shorts wherever I went, just every day. That's all I did was wear shorts. And so everybody could see it. And I don't know how many people told me, farmers and people in the city, they would say, oh, you got bitten by PETA. And antibiotics won't work for that. But I went to the hospital anyway. And so I was wearing shorts, and we were at this demonstration, and afterwards, there were a number of guys sitting on a table. I think maybe I...
up to the guys.
We went up to the guys, and one of the guys says, oh, you got bitten by a PETA. You'll need a sabonero for that. That's a traditional healer. And I thought, well, that's a good idea, but I don't know one. And then a minute later, he said, you know, I know where one is. And I have a car. I'll take you. So then we had a team meeting. It's probably six or eight of us at least. And to decide where to go, and we were really debating whether we whether I should go and or not. And so... we finally decided I really wanted to go because that's, everybody says, I'd tried antibiotics and it hadn't worked, and everybody had said that you'll need a sabonero. Anyway, we decided to go. Three of us went, and we took a radio. So if we got in trouble, I don't know what we would do, but so we can be in communication with the rest of the team. And so... we went, got in this guy's car and went with him, and we didn't go very far till one of the team members who was, must have been along the street while we were driving, radioed us and said, get out of that car. A guy tried to give me a ride when I came to the demonstration that I'm almost sure was a paramilitary, and he was driving a car just like that. Get out of that car. And so the three of us in the car were really trying to figure out what to do or not. And the driver was constantly saying, it's okay, don't worry, go
just
ahead.
To refresh everybody, these are your fellow Christian peacemaker team buddies sort of spotting you, and the guy driving might or might not be a paramilitary who has seen the interfering work that the CPT has done. Okay.
Right.
Just to explain why you're anxious.
Exactly. Thank you.
So the driver says, it's okay.
And somehow or another, we stayed with the driver. I don't know why it's hard to understand, but it was the grace of God, really, as you'll hear. So he, anyway, we staying with him, and then he, you know, one thing he says, we're just about there. Don't worry, we're just about there. And he turned down a dead-end alley, a bunch of guys at the other end. And so we were scared again. You know, we were afraid that maybe these guys were paramilitaries too, and they might kidnap us, they might kill us. Hard telling what they would do. anyway, it wasn't far down there, just maybe a quarter of a block or something, and we got not quite to the guys, and the taxi cab driver, up there's John, up there in the porch. So we decided, we didn't get to, these guys didn't do anything yet. So we went up, and John looked at my bite on my leg, and he says, "Well, are you taking antibiotics?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, I can't help you till tomorrow." Thanks, guy. But he did give me some herbs in the shot glass to drink, which I did. And then the driver, the taxi, no, he really wasn't a taxi. He wasn't a taxi. It was just a, anyway, this guy was still there in the car. And so we went out, and he says, "I'll take you home." We said, "Okay." Because we didn't know where we were and how to get home. And actually, before I left John's, I said, "How do I get back here to come back here tomorrow?" He said, "Just ask any taxi cab driver. They all know where I live." And this is a city of 250,000 people.
They all know where John lives.
Right.
Okay.
It's John.
John.
Anyway, so we went back, and actually when we got home, a number of the team members were having questions about whether I should go back or not, but I wanted to go back. I wanted to get healed from this pita bite, which everybody said I needed to see a sabondero. I could just say a little bit more about the pita bite. I just recently learned from a Colombian friend that is really, really a serious thing. If it gets in your blood, it can really affect your brain. And my brain doesn't need it, needs a lot of help, not any hindrance. What else? Then, so I went back the next day, and he says, "Well, you'll need to get creosote, a number of other things." And one of the things was something in a block, little block of thing. I mean, real small block, about half inch by half inch by half inch, maybe something like that. At the drugstore, and found out that stuff that I had was what undertakers use in embalming. And the creosote, you put it on to keep the flies away. And there was a number of other things, an herb that actually John later showed me where to get some from, just what we call weed just growing along the road there. Anyway, in about 2 weeks, I think it was, I was, this bite was back, my leg, my skin, my, was back to normal. And that's the story of, is there any other questions that...
So didn't John ask if you had any other problems, and you said something about a shoulder?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. To just say, one of the other things about John, his charge was whatever you want to give. And
so what did you give him?
I don't remember, but I probably gave him 5 pesos at least, which was pretty good. I mean, well, I don't know. I might have gave him 10. I you know, it's been 20 years ago. But I, you know, there was people that, what was the other question you asked?
About, I thought he asked about your shoulder.
Oh, my shoulder. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I'd gotten healed from this pita bite, and I thought, well, maybe he might know something about my shoulder. I had had a rotocuff repair on my shoulder at back here in the States, and the surgeon has said, give me some exercise to do, and he says you'll probably have to do them for the rest of your life, 20 minutes a day. I didn't look forward to that. So I thought, maybe John knows something about this. So I asked him, and he felt my shoulder. He says, well, you shouldn't have had that operation. I said, you know, I thought, well, gee, thanks. And he massaged my shoulder and then hit me on the elbow. And he says, okay, now you don't have to do the exercises.
And it worked? Shoulder was okay?
Yeah, but I was bothered from time to time after that. And so I went back, I don't know, every week or so until I was going to the United States. And then I asked him, what do I do now? I can't come see you anymore. And he says, well, just massage your shoulder and hit yourself on your elbow there, and that should work, which I've done over the years quite a bit. And then with time, it seemed to have just gotten better, didn't need to do it anymore. That the shoulder most probably started, I've been a farmer, and started from pruning blueberries, doing the same motion continually, and but I, as I transitioned out of farming, I was no longer doing that.
Did you ever see any of those guys again? The guy that drove you and
never saw him again. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if I said to go back to John's. I just asked a taxi cab driver, oh, yeah, I'll take you. And one time I got to really know John quite well. Mm-hmm. And he actually showed me the book he gets his recipes out of. And what else was I going to say about that?
You got to know him quite well.
Yeah. Can't remember.
Okay, well, that's a great story. Thank you.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe of telling another story or two.
Okay.
Since we're doing this, as I said, the paramilitaries in these farmers that these 80 farms that we were providing protection to, there were two, actually they were divided up into two towns, and the two towns hadn't talked to each other for, I think it was like 17 years, because the one town was controlled by the paramilitaries, and the other one was controlled by the guerrillas. And for example, if someone from the guerrillas would go to visit the town where the paramilitaries were, the guerrillas were think they're taking information for the paramilitaries, and the paramilitaries would think they're coming to spy on us. So they couldn't, they hadn't talked to each other for 17 years. And so they communicated with each other and decided they were going to try and have a soccer game together as a way of breaking the ice between the two communities. And so they asked us to accompany them because they were afraid that they might be there might be violence. The paramilitaries and the guerrillas, the armed, not the communities, but the armed guys on both those armies.
So these two villages expect the eight of you who are unarmed to keep these two sides, both of which are armed, from shooting each other.
Well, hopefully, or from shooting each other when amongst all these civilians here in the town, and they had a soccer game together, and we were there for that, and The one team won 9-0, as I remember.
Was it because you were Americans that they were a little afraid of you?
That was probably a big part of it. It's hard to know. We never asked the guys. And one of the other things was we were unarmed. You know, if we were armed, like I think I said earlier, I probably wouldn't be here.
They would just shoot you.
Yeah. Anyway, after the
did they have guns while they were watching the soccer game?
Actually, the paramilitaries didn't come yet.
Ah.
After the soccer game, you know, I'm a farmer, so I was visiting with the other farmers. I think I was the only American out there in the field visiting them, and then comes a military truck pulls up, and about, I don't know, 15 or 20 paramilitary soldiers get out of the truck. I was a bit scared. Everybody else was in town. They had made a big meal, a big soup for everybody. And so everybody was in town, and so I hiked into town pretty quick. It wasn't very far, maybe a football field length or something like that to get mm-hmm. to town. And so I went in town just to be around people, to be for protection. I didn't know what was going to happen here. And then one of the significant things that happened in town, the commander of these paramilitaries came there and started accuse our boat driver, who was from the guerrilla-controlled community, of being a guerrilla. And me and another volunteer stood right close to them. I mean, we were at the most foot and a half apart while this paramilitary commander was accusing our boat driver of being a guerrilla, and we were, you know, chiming in once in a while, oh no, he's not a guerrilla, etc. And then finally it started to get dark, and they had to get home, and so we said, well, we're going to have to go, and the guy, the paramilitary commander allowed, you know, said, okay, I guess you can go. And so they went home, and one of the interesting things that happened just a few days later, the paramilitaries ended up in our boat driver's house, probably accusing him of being a guerrilla again, and didn't kill him or kidnap him or whatever. And my sense is perhaps one of the reasons he didn't do that, when he was talking to Tico, our boat driver, he got to know Tico a bit. And so if somebody you know, it's hard to shoot them. And I think in a way our presence there probably perhaps saved his life on the second day too. Yeah.
Great. Okay, is there anything else? That's a good story.
Well, another story, back in 1970, I went to Cuba as a I would say I was a radical in that day. That was during the Black Panther era, and I got a chance. Actually, a newspaper reporter told me there's a group going to Cuba, and anybody wants to go. And I had just come home from Colombia, no, from
Bolivia.
Bolivia. Yeah, I had just come home from my three years in Bolivia. And it's still going, I guess. Is still working?
Still working. Okay. I saw that. That's gray now. Okay.
Okay. Anyway, so I decided to go. The Church of the Brethren paid my way, and so I went to Cuba. We spent 6 weeks there cutting sugar cane and 2 weeks touring the country. And we did this as a way of solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. And a couple of things that happened there, a couple of the men, there was about 200 of us, actually we went on a boat. And a couple of the men were sleeping around with some of the women from Cuba. And so I forget who, but, you know, it's been 40 years ago. I talked to somebody about that. I didn't feel that was right. And so the Cubans, some of the Cubans came and pulled me aside and said, "Don't you want to change your opinion about what happened?" And no, that's what happened. I said, "I'm not going to change my opinion." Goes to show a little bit what was happening in Cuba. Another thing that happened, in a town close by where we were encamped, I met a Baptist pastor who was not in favor of the revolution, and he actually asked me to send him some razor blades. But anyway, one of the things he says, I don't agree with Fidel Castro, but he is really, the people, Cubans really support him. He said, if they would, if Fidel would ask them to stand on their heads, they would all do it.
Okay.
What was another thing? I had spent 3 years in Bolivia, and I've traveled quite a bit in South America and countries. And one of the things I noticed about Cuba is that their healthcare system and their education, their schooling, which was all free, was much better than any of the other countries where I was in South America, which was most of the countries in South America. Another thing that happened is when I came home, we had to go through Canada to get on the boat to go to Cuba, and we came back that way too. And when we came back, I lived in Pennsylvania at that time, so I took a bus back home to York, and when I was in the bus station, these guys came in the bus station and just start taking my picture. And I didn't know what they were or what they were doing. And as I thought about it, I bet they're FBI. You know, this was the time of the Black Panthers. And they, in their newspaper, they had put out a notice that people should bump off FBI agents. And so I got the idea. I got out my camera, which didn't work, and pointed it at them, and they hightailed it. was there something else about Cuba? We had an American who was working with an engineer who was working with the Cuban government, trying to help them. He had designed a caterpillar tractor that could cut sugar cane with a machine, and he needed parts. And he told us how the U.S. government refused to allow them, him to have parts sent to Cuba. Is that maybe one of the main stories? Another story I could tell is how I got, which I feel is StoryCorps might be interested in broadcasting, how I got involved with Christian Peacemaker Team.
Yeah, because you were a farmer, and suddenly there you are, wearing your little red hat and joining the team.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
In January 2001, I received an email from Christian Peacemaker Teams, and in the email they said they were in dire need of volunteers for Colombia, especially those who spoke Spanish. And after being 3 years in Bolivia, I still spoke Spanish. And when I received that email, I thought I'd really like to do that. And in the email, they added, you know, this is a very dangerous situation. So when I received that, like I said earlier, I'd really like to do that. But I had at that time 4 kids and 4 grandkids. And I figured, no, they'll never let me do it. And so I didn't say anything to anybody from January till June, not even my wife. And I talked to one of my best friends and pastor of our church. And I asked him, what should I do? I still have this drawing to be a part of Christian Peacemaker Teams. And, you know, I expected him to say, you know, with all your family, you just better forget this. And to my surprise, he said, well, maybe God's calling you to be a peacemaker. And that gave me the courage to talk to my wife and my kids and the rest of the church, and they all affirmed it. And in January, I was in Colombia.
Did they give you training?
Actually, I only had a couple days of training before I went that first time. You know, I spoke Spanish. I've been a farmer. We were going to be working with farmers. Anyway, they trusted that I could come, and they were in dire need of someone, I guess.
And this story you told at the beginning of the traditional healer,
yeah,
where you're confronting these people, you hadn't been a Christian peacemaker very long, because
that
was
right.
2000. Yeah, so there you are, sort of getting a baptism of fire.
Yeah, yeah.
You really trust these guys, but they were trustworthy, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I feel the Lord had His hands in it.
Oh, praise the Lord for that.
You know, that's one of the reasons I'm not an atheist. I was agnostic for quite a few years, and one of the things I've really come to believe is that incidents like that, like if we had not trusted that fella, I don't know what would have happened to me in light of what the petabyte can do to my brain.
John needs to get in touch with the hospital and say, here's what works.
Yeah. Actually, I've been going back to see John every time I go to Colombia, and I could just say I've been there 14 times since 2002. And actually, the last time I went there, I learned that he had passed on.
Oh.
That was really sad to hear. I had some things I wanted to check with him. Actually, his nephew has kind of taken over for him. I know I talked to him about, you need to to train some of your children or one of your children to do this. This is very important. And I could just add one of the things also. In the times I've gone back, just about always, there were two or three other people there in line. You know, and if you were poor, you just had, like I said earlier, all you had to pay was whatever you could. And really, he wasn't in it for the money. He told me that when he was 7 or 8, he got the sense that he was supposed to be a healer. And I guess he's been doing it ever since. And, you know, he doesn't live in a fancy house or anything. I mean, he does have cement floors, which is good and stuff. Although there in Barranca, where the city is cement is fairly common, particularly now. But anyway, he's a good guy. He was a good guy. Well, he still is a good guy. I think he.
Great. Okay.
Okay. Well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, David, for being my companion here.
And Charlie for setting up the equipment.
Yes.
Okay.
Our tech.
That's the end. Can we? What is that thing?
That's your.